that. So since Arne set up the stage pretty nicely about integrating lots of pathways to consider the four important things of biology, I'm going to refocus my energy on just one aspect, which involves probably all of those. And so being a more of a soccer player than a scientist, I guess, by virtue of this at least, I find myself reading pamphlets frequently rather than the literature. And in this case, what I read was this, that is, age is the greatest carcinogen. And here's the summary sentence that comes after this this statement. That is, if you live to the age of 55, you have a 50% chance of getting a tumor from 55 to the end of your life, if you're a man, and 35% chance if you're a woman. Okay? Whereas before that time, unless there's generally a genetic predisposition toward it, a family inheritance, the chance of you getting cancer is very, very low. Okay? So something is going on in, and this gets into my general interest in this, and that is it's an epigenetic phenomenon. Something has changed. And that's why, as Boris said later, I'll talk to you, for those of you who are interested, about epigenetics in a more general sense of silencing. And so here's the data that all this is based on. And here's the age of human beings, and then incidence per 100,000, the rate, or incidence, I should say, of tumors. And the reason, in part, that we decided to, I became interested in this, is when I saw this data set, I was right here on the graph. And in thinking about what's going on here, it became apparent to me that there was no way in hell that we were ever going to figure out how this happens and be able to reverse it by the time I got there. So we started thinking about, and we is a student in my lab, Michael McMurray, we started thinking about whether there was a model system in which we might be able to learn about some fundamental process that happens in cells that might link between age and cancer. Okay? And so in our laboratory, we use yeast Saccharomyces cerevisiae, the budding yeast that you heard a little bit about. And the experiments I'm going to tell you about today that Michael did have only two assays that you have to know about. And I'll show you some of the data and how we analyze it. But I just have to explain those two. And first of all, before explaining them, the thing is that yeast, we can age those cells, and they undergo what's called a replicative lifespan. And I'll show you what I mean by that in a minute. And the second thing is they don't really get cancer in the sense of this renewal, like what Arne was talking about earlier. But what they do have is one of the hallmarks of cancer, and that is genomic instability, something that comes around. So let's talk about genomic instability first. So what Michael set up was an assay to look for genomic instability. And the assay that he chose to use was setting up a diploid organism. So we have two chromosomes, one from mom and one from dad. And he set it up such that there was heterozygosity between the two chromosomes. So first of all, let me ask, how many of you have physics background? How many of you physicists have biology background? Mixed in with that? A little bit mixed? Okay. So the other thing is, if you have any questions about anything I'm talking about, please just feel free to interrupt me, whether clarification or question about what's going on. So we have two chromosomes. One is has a big blue that gives us, let's say, blue color, and one is a recessive mutation, little m, which doesn't, when big blue is there, you get a blue color, and you don't when the two are there present. But if you lose big blue, then the cells become m. Okay, and they have a phenotype that changes correspondingly. So in this case, there are actually quite a few ways that you can get loss of heterozygosity, but one of them is a recombination in which you lose big blue and convert big blue to little m, Or you lose the entire chromosome and you just are left with little m. Okay? So I ask you to remember that. So that's pretty simple. And these are the assays that we use in our case, or a couple of them, I'll just tell you. So, and they're all color-based. And I'll be showing you some data in just a tiny bit. So if we have heterozygosity for a gene called MET15, where it's big M MET15, which is the dominant, and little m MET15, the cells are white. However, and if we put those cells on a different media, they'll stay white. But if we have a mutation that converts the big M MET15 to little MET15, so we now have two MET15s, those cells become brown. Okay. We also have one for ADD2 that they go from white to red. So we have colors that will change, and that's what you're going to see in a few minutes. All right? But tell us when we lose heterozygosity. So this is how we do aging, one of the ways we do aging in yeast, and that is by what's called replicative lifespan. And this was originally noted 50 years ago by Johnston. And what they discovered is that, as Arnie told you, we start out with a mother cell, and then she buds off a cell which we call the daughter cell. And the number of divisions, or the number of daughters that the mother cell gives off, is her lifespan. And we call that replicative lifespan because it's the number of times the mother can replicate. And in the things I'm going to tell you about, they replicate normally about 35 or 40 times, and then they stop. Now, this contrasts with what Arnie told you about. This is a type of senescence, in essence, it's senescence, that is different than what Arnie told you about. And that is the idea about telomeres don't change in yeast, in budding yeast. So that's not the limiting step in this organism, okay, for this replicative lifespan. So what we do to determine the age is Michael sits on a microscope and he watches the mother divide, give off a daughter, and then he picks that daughter cell and moves her away from the mother and is able to then count the number of daughters that she generates. And in this sort of shortened lifespan, mom goes three generations, her lifespan is three, giving off three daughters, and then she pops. And I will also tell you right now, we don't really understand what it is, what's going on with regard to popping. Stopping dividing and you pop. Okay, that's what death is for a yeast, right? In this case.
You say pop.
It lyses. The cell lyses. Yeah.
But don't you have cases where you can inhibit growth in yeast without lysis?
Yes, and so that's sort of the situation that Arnie was telling you about, where we we starve them, and they go into a stationary phase, and they'll just hang out there literally for months in some cases. Or if it's a different set of starving situations, they'll actually undergo meiosis and go into a spore, which is a protective encysted state. So it has three, if you keep it in food all the time, this is what will eventually happen. If you remove nutrients, it'll go into this encysted form.
Could you be a little more subtle about that? What about rich medium and poor medium? Does that make a difference?
Yes, it does. And where it does is in this caloric restriction aspect, the number of cell divisions that a mother will undergo is in rich media, let's say it's 30. If we put it under
generation
is 90 minutes.
90 minutes.
And even under restricted media, let's say, so if we go from 2% glucose to 0.5 or 0.2% glucose in order of magnitude, we'll still see the same relative generation time, so it's in excess, but the number of cell divisions will be longer. It'll go from 30 to maybe 40 or 50. Okay? Yeah.
I think I missed it.
Yes.
Yes.
That's right. And he's doing 50 at a time.
He stays up for like
4 days.
Yeah, that's
That's normal for...
Yeah, for graduate students in Seattle, that's not a big deal.
No problem. Good coffee.
Really good.
That's right. No, we have a setup in my lab, and there's a couch and a cot and a, you know. and then he comes back after 2 days of sleep and starts again. I also mentioned that he has since graduated and is no longer interested in these kinds of experiments. Well, the only reason that this experiment happened, though, is that Michael was so interested in this question that he was willing to put in this effort, which was Herculean, actually, as you just realized. So I want to show you a little bit of data, and I'll show you how he did this experiment in a little more detail. So he starts out with a Petri dish, and then he'll start out on each Petri dish with two mothers, two virgin mothers. And I can tell you later or now what a virgin is, if you need to know. And what he'll do then is wait and then place that first daughter here, second daughter here, etc., and then allow those cells, those daughter cells, to grow up into a colony. And then retrospectively, he can look at the life history of the mother through her daughters. Okay? And this is just showing you a little bit of the data from a particular panel in which we're starting at division 25 is what I'm showing you. And for those of you who have ever seen yeast colonies, these look kind of nasty. And the reason is because we've replicaplated them onto these different media so that we can see the color development that I told you about. And that permits this color development. They're diploid yeast, yep, exactly. So this is different than what most people do in yeast. They usually do haploid genetics. Okay. And this turned out to be important. And what Michael noticed is that for the first, and I don't show you the top, but the first, 34, 35 generations, you see no colors in the colonies. And then suddenly here, we see color in the colony. The next colony has some. This one does, a couple that don't, but then this one does. I should blow these up. and you can color. Not color, 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 color. Whereas before that, there was none. So that tells us that suddenly, in the life history of this mother, we suddenly see that her daughters are having a much higher level of genomic instability or loss of heterozygosity. Okay? And we can quantify that and in a couple different ways. Yeah?
Do these genes do anything, or are they just markers?
They're just markers in our case. And so otherwise, these things are isogenic, or homozygous, I should say, at all the other loci.
I guess maybe we'll talk about it. Daughters of daughters, can you keep on having the trouble, or are you dying?
I'll get to that. And the short answer is it dilutes out eventually. And that's quite interesting, actually. And so we can, for instance, see here that early on, so this is, we're doing the plot exactly as we had for the tumor incidents. We see early on that there's nothing going on in terms of loss of heterozygosity. And I should mention the way we made our cutoff is that if a daughter had, the whole colony was colored, telling us that the daughter cell that landed had LOH, or if it was half-sectored, which means after her first cell division of the daughter, an event happened, all the way to eighth sector, so which means within three divisions of her landing on the plate that something happened. And so we see this incredible increase such that by the end of the lifespan of these very old mothers, her daughters, 50% of them have LOH. Okay? So the other thing we wanted to look at was, so this is just showing you one particular pedigree, that is from one mother. What's sort of the distribution of lots of mothers if we do this? And what Michael plotted was, when was the incidence in which we saw the first LOH event in a particular pedigree? And he plots it here. And what you can see, it's roughly a Gaussian distribution centered around 25 cell divisions. So if these cells are normally living about 40 cell divisions, late in life, suddenly you see this first incidence of loss of heterozygosity. And then what he did, yeah?
You need a you need two copies of the recessive to get the color?
No.
How do you know that you're not getting point mutations that are causing that?
I'll show you a little bit of information in a few minutes, but basically we go in and we have a whole bunch of other polymorphisms that we can look at, and we find that it's actually all recombination, and we can see that in essence. So first event happens at 25, but then if we ask the question, if you get that first event, how many cell divisions do you go between the first event and the second event, and the second event and the third event, etc.? And when we do that, we see that it follows roughly a Poisson distribution, telling us that now it's set to a new higher level of loss of heterozygosity, a new higher rate, and it's constant, if you will. Hence why there's a Poisson distribution. All right? And so I think I put on the next slide what the relative rates are, and this is in young cells when we do just a fluctuation analysis on a population of growing cells. This is for two different loci that we were looking at, their relative rates of loss of heterozygosity. And then when we look at the old guys that I was telling you about, that is after that first loss of heterozygosity in the pedigree and everybody subsequent, it's about 45-fold here and about 200-fold at this locus. So we'll split the difference and call it about 100-fold increase in loss of heterozygosity. So what we've seen is that there's an amazing switch at roughly cell division number 25 in genomic instability. It seems to be maintained at that constant 100-fold through the rest of the lifespan of the mother. Okay?
When the dominant locus
is lost. That's right.
It's possible that the loss of heterozygosity
went the other way. Absolutely. So you can multiply that by two then, roughly, to get an approximation. Yep. Absolutely. So as someone asked, these point mutations, etc., we did a lot of characterization. I won't go into the details, to look at chromosome loss. So basically what we did is we had other markers all along the chromosomes here on both sides of big M that allowed us to know whether we had loss or recombination or point mutations, etc. And the take-home message is that it was all recombination, every single one that we saw in this age-induced loss of heterozygosity. So that tells us something very important qualitatively that's different, and I'll focus on that next. So there are a couple recombination pathways to generate loss of heterozygosity. So if we start out with two chromosomes, mom and dad, blue and red, and we replicate those two chromosomes, so now we have 1, 2, 3, 4, what I'm going to do is segregate the even-numbered sister chromatids to one cell and the odds to another, okay? But if in the process we end up with a broken chromosome, let's say a double strand break, which initiates most recombination, then in one scenario we can have what's called reciprocal recombination. And here we get exchange of blue up to here, picks up a piece of red out to here, and conversely on number three, red to here, and then it picks up blue out to there. And the reason it's called reciprocal is that while we started with heterozygosity, that is equal amounts of blue and red in the tails, in this particular cell we have blue-blue, and here we have red-red. Okay, so we've lost heterozygosity in both cells, but it's reciprocal. That is, one became red and one became blue. Okay, the other type of recombination we can have is what's called non-reciprocal, and that's when this guy, blue, invades red, but then you don't get an exchange. You only pick up or copy information off of red down here. And so in that scenario, we get a red-red down here, but this stays wild type. So that's why it's called non-reciprocal. Only one of the pair has changed. That is, one has lost heterozygosity. All right? So knowing that, in young cells, we see that 80% of the time, we get reciprocal recombination, all right? But in old cells, the converse is true. That is, 90% of the time, it's non-reciprocal. So that tells us qualitatively there's something very different about the kind of recombination and the mechanism of loss of heterozygosity that happens in old cells and what happens normally in cells. Okay? So something is going awry is what it's telling us in a specific way. Now, again, just getting to what type of recombination or how do you know, you can have two different types of non-reciprocal recombination. One that's called gene conversion. It's just a little track is changed. So you have red just right here. Or you can have break-induced replication, which occurs when this guy invades this guy down here and then replicates all the way out to the end, to the telomere, and hence picks up an entire arm, if you will, of red. And that's called break-induced replication. And it turns out that all the age-induced loss of heterozygosity occurs by break-induced replication. And that also will turn out to be important in thinking about what's going on in the cell. Okay? So, up to now, we've got increased recombination for the loss of heterozygosity. It's all not, virtually 90% is non-reciprocal, which is different. And it's all via break-induced replication, which is unusual. So when you have a non-reciprocal state, I told you that one stays wild type and the other goes mutant, or LOH. Which one is it? A priori, we would predict that the mom and the daughter should have equal probabilities of this happening to them. Okay? So Michael asked a simple question, again, using the same data set. He got a lot of information out of this staying up all night. Whether it happened, loss of heterozygosity, occurred in the mother or in the daughter for each event. And so if we follow a pedigree up here on the top, and we see a loss of heterozygosity in one colony, and then all subsequent colonies have loss of heterozygosity, that tells us that it happened in the mother right here, okay, in the preceding division, because all the progeny inherit that. Conversely, if we see a loss of heterozygosity in one cell and the next cell division or daughter has wild type, then we know it happened in that particular daughter because mom is giving wild type again. So what we see at the two loci that we looked at is an amazing bias. That is, in both loci, 20 to 1, 18 to 1, whatever you want to say, it's roughly that that the daughter is getting loss of heterozygosity and mom is not. In other words, the moms are being protected from the genomic instability, it appears. All right. Now, I'll throw this out just as sort of a fun idea to think about, since you heard a little bit about stem cells. If we consider the mother cell as an equivalent to a stem cell in a population, in a human or metazoan, then if the mother is somewhat recalcitrant to LOH, the daughter will, let's say, have LOH, but that allows the mother to, in the future, propagate her wild-type genome in subsequent daughters, okay? To propagate herself, if you will, in an accurate manner. So we think about that right now and what the implications might be. Right now it's just sort of for fun, but at least in the yeast world you can think about it. But we speculate whether or not this may be going on in metazoans. So, what's the basis for this age-induced asymmetry? Well, there's two hypotheses that we're thinking about. And the first one is a model that was put forth by John Cairns a long time ago. And that is that somehow the mother cell, or the stem cell, knows the difference between the mutant or the parental chromosome and one that is messed up. Okay? And the mom holds on to the good chromosome. Alright? I don't like that idea. But there's another one that may explain all the data, and that is an observation made by Andrew Murray and Jack Szostak, which if you take a plasmid in yeast that has an origin of replication, a marker on it, but it does not have a centromere, so it can replicate, but it doesn't get segregated equally by mitosis. Then there's an amazing bias for the mother to hold on to that piece of DNA. That is, the DNA after replication, instead of being distributed between mom and daughter, stays in mom. Okay? 20-to-1 bias, it turns out. So the converse of what I was telling you about here. So, let's see if we can put a model together right now to explain all this. So here's the idea. We've replicated the two genomes in two different situations. Mom is on the left and daughters are on the right. And what I'm going to do is introduce a chromosome break in these guys, and then in one case, segregate. Let me just hold on. I'm going to break one of these chromosomes in each case. And in one case, I'm going to segregate the broken chromosome via its centromere, which is the red dot here, to the daughter. In the other case, I'll keep it in the mom. So in doing that, in the top case, segregating the broken chromosome to the daughter, I told you that acentric fragments, things without centromeres, tend to stay in moms. So hence, what's going to happen here is that this fragment is going to be retained in the mother, and the daughter is sort of in trouble because she has no way to repair this except to get information off of the homolog. In contrast, if the broken chromosome is retained in the mother, 50-50 probability, but because this acentric fragment is maintained, it has a chance to rejoin by what's called non-homologous end joining. Okay? So, in this case, this guy gets copied by this break-induced replication, which replicates all the way to the telomere, which is what we saw 100% of the time. Okay? So, we think then that this may explain sort of the mechanism by which the mother is able to retain a wild-type genome by holding on to that stuff. And the daughter is the one who has to deal with the new damaged chromosome. Now, one last thing. You guys heard a little bit about DNA damage checkpoints. So did you guys hear about that yet? So it turns out that there are all these systems in the cell to make sure that if something goes awry, there's time or at least an attempt to deal with it. And one of them is called the DNA damage checkpoint, where if the chromosome gets damaged, the cell will wait before it undergoes mitosis and try to heal that damage. Okay? Turns out in yeast, when you get damage, the cell can arrest instead of dividing every 90 minutes. It'll arrest for 8 to 10 hours until the damage is dealt with. And after that 10 hours, if it isn't dealt with, then it'll go on and divide. Okay? Well, because of the way Michael did his experiments here, and I'll just sort of show you what this is his way of putting all this data down. Each line represents the pedigree of one particular mother. Each circle represents when a daughter came off on this timeline down here. And then if there's a color, it represents that there was a loss of heterozygosity event in that daughter. And so what I hope you can see is while there's quite a few of these LOH events along here, the distance between the circles hasn't changed, even when they're way back here, in which there's no loss of heterozygosity events. What that is telling us is that there's no DNA damage checkpoint. There's no delay in the cell cycle before you see this loss of heterozygosity. Okay? And so it's somehow getting bypassed by a mechanism that we don't really know yet, but I'll speculate about in a second. Okay? So, just sort of summarize up to here, we see LOH in aging yeast cells is age-dependent increase in LOH. It switches sort of to 100-fold higher rate after about 25 cell divisions. It's all linked to recombination, which to us means its DNA damage is somehow not being dealt with properly. And something I didn't show you, but I'll tell you about right now, is that this age-related increase in loss of heterozygosity is on its own age clock. And what I mean by that is Michael did a couple experiments in which he genetically increased the lifespan of the yeast from 40 to roughly 75 or 80 cell divisions and asked, when does the loss of heterozygosity happen, the first event? And he found that it still happened at 25. Even though these cells live twice as long, it still happened at 25. So that tells us that we've, in essence, unlinked the mother's decision to stop dividing and lysing, popping, from what's going on in the subsystem. And we're kind of excited about this because if we use the analogy of a car and aging, which has been used quite a bit, you can have a BMW, and it may be that the transmission goes out at 150,000 miles. However, if you've got a radio in it like mine, it'll go out. The radio part will go out at 20,000 miles. You know, and so if you look at the subsystem, you can understand something about damage or aging for that particular subsystem, which may then get back to understanding ultimately what the causal event is for that subsystem. Whereas if you just look at total death, you don't really necessarily know how it happened. So, anyways, in this case.
So maybe if I see that part of the answer, but is it really the 25 has to be counted in cell divisions, or there is a time scale? If you had fewer cell divisions, you can still imagine there is some factory churning out one species of another species of protein as a marker.
We know that it's temperature dependent, for instance. So it suggests to us that it's the amount of metabolism, if you will, that's going on. And we can also modulate it with caloric restriction, for instance, as another thing, which I won't show you the data. But we can, for instance, if we cool the temperature down on these things, then the LOH event will happen earlier in the lifespan, even though they'll live just as long. If we decrease the number of calories we give them, then we push the loss of heterozygosity to much, much, much later. Okay? And so it looks like it's metabolism, some aspect. I mean, again, you heard from Artie that there's so many inputs into this. We're not sure exactly where it is just yet. And that's what we're trying to figure out.
So across the population, you have this distribution of times at which LOH first event, right?
Yep. That's right. Mm-hmm.
But within a single line, is the expected time of the first LOH actually genetic? So if the mother has an LOH at prematurely early, like in the 15th division, then is it likely that the daughters will have their first LOH also prematurely early and so on, or is that?
Yes. So we've looked at that in a limited way. That is, we've taken some guys that were all genetically identical. The average was 25. We took guys that came out early or came out late and then looked at their progeny in this and put them back through the pedigree. And we saw that it redistributed around 25. So it was just, so that part was it appears to be non-genetic. Okay.
Yeah. Dan, have you tried growing them under conditions where double strand breaks would increase by, you know, not major, but some factor 3 or 4 fold, and seeing whether that affects the clock and et cetera. What I'm wondering about is one of your models that, let's say there's a single gene that when it gets hit, that would be consistent with metabolism, maybe if there's hydroxyl radical or something like that generated from metabolism, you hit a single gene or maybe a single gene, and that, boom, starts this aging process. I'm just trying to think about ways to test that.
Yeah. We're setting up to ask the question sort of maybe a step before what you're getting at, and that is it that the old cells are defective in repair, or are they having more damage per se? And we've got a system now set up to ask that, but I don't have the answer yet. And with regard to our idea about how this is happening, I'll actually show you a little bit of information about that. It's unlinked to the loss of the irks.
The recombination event, though.
Yes, it is.
Is that a linear, yours is a discontinuous function.
That's right.
Is that a linear function or a discontinuous function as well?
In irks, it's a continuous function. Yeah, and so we originally, I didn't go through this, but we wondered if that was a causal event in this. That is, you hit a threshold of accumulating those things, and then boom. And one of the age expansion things is getting rid of those irks by a recombination mutation. And those are the guys that we still saw at division 25. It still happens. That is the LOH. Yeah. Oh, sorry.
So when does this happen, this loss of heterozygous, if you like, when does this recombination happen? Because if it happens at the time of, say, budding, then wouldn't you expect 50% cells red and 50% of the cells? Like, you wouldn't expect a half-sectored colony or something? But in some of the colonies that you showed us, it's just a small streak.
Yep. I'm gonna talk about that in a minute. Yep, that's a good question. Yeah, did you have a question? Okay. So, I alluded to this already, but I want to show you a little bit of information that helps get to your question as well. Is the age-induced LOH switch permanent? And so, what Michael did to address that is we have several markers in these strains which allow us to see loss of heterozygosity. So what Michael did is he took one of these late guys that had an LOH event at one locus and then looked at the other loci when he took the progeny, the great-great-great-great-great-great-granddaughters of those cells, because by the time you generate a colony, it's roughly about 10 million cells, and that means you're 2 to the 25th generations away. Okay, so you've gone through 25 doublings. So he takes that cell and then puts it back through the pedigree analysis, one cell at a time. And what he saw was for those other loci, the loss of heterozygosity was back down to the low level, and at division 25, boop, it went back up. So that tells us that it's not a genetic change. There's something else going on here, okay? So, a second question, the second way that Michael looked at this issue is in the sectors that he saw in the LOH, which you noted. And so, if we start out with a mother cell, and this is supposed to be the daughter, and he puts one of those daughter cells, and the loss of heterozygosity was in that cell, then the whole colony, this is what this is supposed to represent, is colored. If it happened at the first division after he pulled off the daughter, when she was starting to form a colony, then we get a half sector, okay? If it happened in the after two divisions, it'll be a quarter sector, and if it happened after three divisions, it'll be an eighth sector. Okay? Just sort of standard expectations. If this is 1x, the frequency of this occurring in a population, then you expect quarter sectors to happen twice as much and eighth sectors to happen four times as much. Everything, all things being equal, that is, frequency of loss of heterozygosity in all cells. What he found in young cells is that it followed this pretty closely. So if this is roughly 1 and this is 2-fold, these are the actual numbers for the occurrence of these things in a population, and he got roughly 5-fold, okay, for young cells that had LOH. But in old cells, in those pedigrees that I showed you, the frequencies were very different. And that is, if it was 1 for half sectors, it was just a little higher, 1.4 for quarter sectors, but it was only 1 for eighth sectors. That tells us that not all 8 cells here had an equal probability of having LOH compared to what was going on when it was the first cell division. So what we think is going on then is that there's a dilution out of whatever the factor is that's causing a loss of heterozygosity. Right, and that's consistent also with the other experiment I told you about, where things got reset.
But did they reset immediately, first generation?
From this, we would say, this experiment sort of gets at that a little bit. From this, it doesn't happen in the first generation.
That's what I wonder, because with the daughters, that's what I wonder. With the daughters, you said, based on what my interpretation, what you said was that it was back reset. But I guess the trick is, it was 25 generations at which you started, but you don't know. Okay, that's a tough one.
Yeah. So it looks like it's resetting within three doublings already. Is what I mean. We don't know what the exact number should be here, but it's starting to go down by the third generation, okay, or third doubling. So it's getting diluted out pretty quickly. Is the idea? Does that make sense? So here's our sort of hypothesis to explain what's going on, and it's rather nebulous at this point. And it's based on an idea that had been put out by Jaswinski just to explain lifespan in general in yeast. And that is, on the top panel here, what I have is a mother cell, and each time it's her after another division, another cell division. And down here is each of her progeny that she's giving off after that cell division. And what the red stuff is our buildup of a LOH instability factor, a genomic instability factor. And I'll come back to what I think it is in a few minutes. And that there's two parts of this. One, it's a buildup in the mother cell of this thing. And the second part is that there's asymmetry in the distribution of this factor. So it builds up in the mother, but the daughters at this point are not getting it. And once the buildup of this factor hits a critical threshold, then you see genomic instability. Okay? And after some time, there is so much of this nasty factor that, let's say it's a 90-to-1 distribution asymmetry, then even if 10% of that stuff goes over to the daughter, it acts as a seed for her to start having genomic instability. Okay? Does that make sense? And so, but that daughter, it has this asymmetry too, so the great-granddaughter in this particular pedigree is starting to dilute out already because of this 90-10, let's say it's 90-10 bias. So what in the world could this stuff be? It turns out there was a nice paper almost 2 years ago now, it was in 2003, from Thomas Nystrom. And what Thomas looked at was something that's been known for quite a while to occur in old cells, and that is the accumulation of what are called carbonylated proteins. And carbonylated proteins are proteins in which you have a, I'll see if I can draw here. So this is sort of the business end of lysine. Can you guys see it there? This is the business end of lysine. There's more carbons here, but I don't have that much chalk. what happens in carbonylation is that reactive oxygen species, which is what you talked a little bit about today, can happen over time, is that when you have reactive oxygen, it will rip off the amine and replace it with a double bonded oxygen, which is a carbonyl group, on lysines especially. And there's a reagent to be able to detect that, and it turns out it's the only reagent for all the types of oxidative damage that can happen. This is probably the only reagent that's working right now that's available. So it's the only one we can see. And what Thomas's lab did is, this is a yeast, a mother yeast and a daughter yeast in Brightfield. And they did in situ staining with this reagent that allows you to detect carbonylated damaged proteins in general. And what they saw was that there was I really didn't want to because I couldn't remember how many carbons are on lysine. That there was accumulation of damaged protein, this carbonylated protein, in the mother cell and not in the daughter. Okay? So here's where the asymmetry is happening and the accumulation aspect of this. And one of the things that they also saw is, in a fractionation attempt, study, What we're looking at here, the white bars correspond to the amount, number of cells that are mother cells with carbonylated protein in them, and the hash bars are daughter cells that may have carbonylated protein by this staining. And what each of these fractions represent is increasing age of the mother. And what you can, what they saw is that when the mothers were really old, the daughters started having a higher probability of having the damaged protein in them as well. Okay, as if they're dumping it into them when they're really old. So we think then, sort of, here's sort of try to explain now our hypothesis about what's going on, is that there's no genetic damage in the sense of it's not heritable. I shouldn't say it that way. We know there's loss of heterozygosity, but the causal event is not a genetic change necessarily. What we think is going on is that you're getting damaged protein that's accumulating in the mother, and that becomes functionally null. That is, functionally protein that's no longer functioning properly. It's being retained in the mother, and that some protein or proteins that are important in genomic maintenance, stability, are those proteins that are being damaged. Okay? Does that make sense? But that the daughter cells are able to sort of bypass this, or it dilutes out, because they're synthesizing new protein from a good gene. All right? So, we've been starting to look at ways of trying to figure this out. And I'll tell you at least one way. We actually wondered about that, and I wasn't going to talk about it, but I'll tell you in a succinct way. We have a paper coming out in which we wondered whether there was a pathway for getting rid of this stuff, specifically in the nucleus, because that's where we came. Because in the cytoplasm, there are pathways. Some of them have to do with the unfolded protein response, etc., which are well characterized, and which can recognize damaged protein, and they just trash it. They take it to the proteasome, like what, and destroy it, like what Arnie was telling you about. But nothing's been known about it in the nucleus. So what we discovered is there is a pathway indeed that is just specific for the nucleus and helps to get rid of proteins like this. We don't know what all the signatures are for what's aberrant, but we think that over time, in an aging cell, it gets swamped out by this kind of pathway. And the reason that this is exciting to us is the pathway we discovered, at least, is a kind that requires ubiquitin to be added to proteins, and ubiquitin, and then that serves as a tag to have them destroyed. Turns out that ubiquitin requires the lysine, the amine on lysine, to do this. So you can envision, if you have carbonylation, that changes the chemistry of lysine, and you bypass this whole degradation pathway. Does that make sense? So we actually have some evidence that that is indeed true for some of these guys. So.
And the reason that it's distributed asymmetrically
between mother and daughter? That is part of the million-dollar question.
There.
That's right. It's a closed mitosis.
Which happens in other organisms a lot. So could it be this is contained in the mother because of an envelope that's in the nuclear envelope?
Yes, part of it could be, absolutely. But the staining that I showed you there was also cytoplasmic. So it may be unique to yeast. I'll continue to play your devil's advocate here. And that is, yeast is a budding, the Cerevisiae is a budding yeast. And it has to force things through a small orifice rather than fission type divisions that normally happen. That said, there are a lot of cells that are asymmetric in their division as well. So we speculate only at this time that this may be relevant to a subset of other types of cells as well. But it may be peculiar to yeast. There are So, for instance, the chromosomes are equally distributed. The nucleoplasm is equally distributed because of microtubules and the proteins that bind to all those guys between the mother and the daughter. The mitochondria are equally distributed, but there are active processes to make that happen. Yeah.
The problem is there isn't a daughter and a mother, right? There's no mother, there's daughters.
Well, actually, there...
Is there an aging phenomenon?
There is. And the way you tell it is, so the cells... Let's see if I can do this. The cells are elongated, typically. And the way things happen is that there's one end in which growth occurs, and then you get fission. And the side that in which growth occurs is the mother, and that just keeps going. So you can see where the asymmetry is, and that has a limited lifespan or number of fissions. Yeah.
I think I must have missed something in your model. You said earlier on, your dad said earlier on that the daughter cells are the ones that are getting this loss of their autonomy.
That's right.
How does that?
Because the mother, though, the damage is happening in the mother, but because she's holding on to not only this damaged protein, but the broken piece of DNA that's acentric, the repercussion is in the daughter.
But the repercussion wasn't on the first generation, it was after the daughter had divided, right?
Yes, but with each subsequent division, there were fewer chances that the daughter had an LOH event because it was being diluted out. I was telling you about. So what was happening is we saw some cells that were completely LOH. That is, the whole colony was colored. That told us the daughter was. But then we saw those sectored things: half sector, quarter sector. And the other thing I told you about was that when the mother hits a certain threshold of accumulating damaged protein, she then passes on a significant amount of that damaged protein to the daughter. So the daughter is like an old mother herself as well. And that's where the event happens. Does that help to answer your... Did you get that?
So then would this imply that no matter what age the mother is, that the daughter should have some... fall off even if the mother's not older?
Yeah, so in fact, what we see, and other people have done this just for aging, not for loss of heterozygosity, is that if you once you hit some threshold, so for instance, if the cells have an average lifespan of 40 divisions, and you take a daughter from division 38, so a daughter from a very old mother, the number of divisions that daughter has is not 40. She only gets about 5 or 10. So she has inherited a whole bunch of crap, if you will, from the mother. Does that help to answer your question? But yet if you take the granddaughter of that one, she started to live a little longer now. Or the great-great-granddaughter has reset it virtually back to 40. Does that help?
Yeah.
Yeah, Ed?
Is it possible to do a computer simulation of this model and see what kind of predictions you would make?
We haven't done it, but it would definitely be fun to try, especially given the data sets that we have. Yeah. Colobacter and subtilis, I think, Bacillus subtilis. I know people have talked about it.
In Colobacter, there's two forms. One is tethered to like a biofilm.
Uh-huh.
And the other one is roaming around. And only the one that's tethered divides and gives rise to a new roaming one. And the roaming ones, at a certain point, they go through a switch and then also tether to biofilm in the new ones. And these guys that sit on the biofilm, they only do a certain number of
divisions that they give, and they pop.
Is there epigenetic labeling of the DNA? Is that like
methylated fantasy? Yeah, no, there isn't. There's no, yeah, so far none. Yeah, people have looked pretty hard for that one, but none in there. So I just want to maybe tell you a little bit about some things that are ongoing, just to help to introduce ideas of how to think about this problem. And this first one is, we like to figure out if there are these damaged proteins, who are they? What are they? Okay. And so to test our hypothesis, we've got to go through a lot of work to get the information we discovered. And so here's sort of the essence of the problem. Here's our gene being transcribed. In a normal situation, it gives a gene product that's hunky-dory, just working fine. But in an old cell, that gene product has been damaged. Okay? And when it's damaged, it becomes functionally null eventually. All right? So how in the world can we find what that gene product might be? Well, it's hard to, but we're working on techniques to look at old cells, but we wanted to set up a screen to look for such things. And the way we've done it is a very simple idea. Let's just see if we get the same phenotype in young cells when we just mutate the gene. Yeah, Boris?
What is the lifetime of your average protein? How fast can you turn on the right? You're saying that
yeah.
You get transcribed and fall you off as opposed to something else.
Oh, no. I didn't mean that. This is a very long arrow. So it's been transcribed.
So how fast is the turnover?
It depends on the protein. So some proteins have a half-life of a couple minutes. Some have it for half a day to days. So it really depends. And what we're... Well, what we're wondering or thinking is that it might be short-lived proteins, but if they get damaged in the right way, they can't be turned over anymore. That's what we think is happening. And that's what we're, sort of what our bias is, but we'll see. So the idea then is, let's just look for things that look like, it's sort of like the progeria diseases. Let's look for things that have LOH that looks like old cells, but in young cells instead. And it turned out that we had thought we could just go to the literature and look for everything that was available. But as I alluded to earlier, everything that's been done in yeast, and there is a lot that's been done on genomic instability, has been done in haploid cells. And what we began to appreciate is that there are two things that are different in diploid cells and haploid cells. One is you have a homologous chromosome, so you can have LOH. And the other is that there's a system built in yeast that when you're haploid, you suppress homologous recombination and increase non-homologous end joining, whereas in your diploid, you suppress non-homologous end joining and increase. So the rules are different for several reasons. So we had to go in and do this ourselves. And so the thing that I just remind you is that old cells switch to a hyper-recombinational state. So that's how we set up a screen for this. And remember our friend MET15, heterozygous situation, the cells are white, they become brown when there's loss of heterozygosity. Well, if you have a cell that's growing up into a colony and there's a high rate of loss of heterozygosity at that, then you'll see sectoring, okay? And so, turns out that the yeast community, so I'm doing a little sales pitch here, is a great organism to do experiments in. And one of the benefits is that there was a consortium a number of years ago of scientists that got together and knocked out every non-essential gene, and now that's available as a collection of about 4,800 deletion sets. Turns out that amazingly fortuitously, we just looked at the data set, the way that they made haploid versions of that and they made diploid versions of the diploid deletion of the deletion set. And then the diploid set, what they had done to make the two haploids was they had one marker And one of those markers, which was heterozygous, was MET15, the guy I was telling you about. So what Daisy did is she went to the freezer, she took out all 4,800 strains, and she simply put them on this special medium that allows you to see black versus white. And she got 130 genes out of 4,800 just like that in 2 weeks, in which we saw this kind of hypersectoring here and here, which told us high levels of loss of heterozygosity. She has then gone on to look for the other aspects of loss of heterozygosity of old cells, and those are increased recombination that is non-reciprocal, so that's unusual, and also things that occur by BIR, and also that have a bias toward LOH in the daughter. And she's not quite through it all, but we already have a set in which I'll just show you what we have. So what I have over here is brown and red are two different genetic loci. And what we're looking at is the increase of loss of heterozygosity, where wild type is unity, and that fold increase rate of loss of heterozygosity, in wild type and old cells. So this is just sort of our standard, what we're looking for. And then all these guys over here are our mutants, where you see an increase that looks similar in terms of the two loci in some of these guys that are like old cells. And then Daisy went on to look at reciprocal versus non-reciprocal character. So wild-type cells, when you have LOH, it's mostly reciprocal, whereas in old cells, it's mostly non-reciprocal. So then she took those guys on the top and looked at them in this way. And it turns out we have three pathways that turn out to have this sort of asymmetry that looks like loss of heterozygosity in old cells. So that now puts us in to at least sort of limits us from all the pathways that it could be to three possible candidates. And so we're now actively pursuing those three pathways to see if they're the things that are going awry in old cells. And the way we do that is we tag the cells, tag the proteins, age the cells, and see if they change either their post-translational modifications and or their ability to segregate between the mother and the daughter in terms of aggregation, etc. So that's what we're doing right now.
Do any of these change the lifespan of mothers?
Yes. They almost all start to shorten the lifespan. Yeah. In the initial. Yeah.
So going back to
Yeah.
Put up a picture of the sector that went very fast. So just looking at it, the sector don't occur in the center.
Yeah.
So just looking at the diameter where it first occurs gives you an idea of the probability of.
It's a little biased. You're right, it could, but. These turn out, the way she did this is she didn't put down just a single cell, she put down about 10,000 cells right in the middle. So then you'll only get outgrowth from the edges, if you will. Okay? Yeah.
Right.
Yep. And in fact, some of the guys, they're too hard to see, but some of them are recombination repair proteins. And so they would, it's now some of the DNA damage repair systems, it's turning out that some of the very enzymes that do the repairing or do the checkpoint are part of the checkpoint. That's right. That's right.
So if the protein is broken and the damage doesn't disappear, you would expect it would make new repair protein, right?
Right. But we don't know what's going on yet. But you could So I can tell you a lot of stories. I don't know if I'm ready to do that. But you can envision that there's a feedback also, and if it thinks the protein's there but it's not functioning, it may not induce. So, I mean, I just don't know at this point what the issue is. But hopefully we'll be able to figure that out now. And then the last thing, just for fun, so this is Michael doing his pedigree. To do these experiments, as I said, is a labor of love, because you've got to sit on that scope for all the days that you need and wait for these LOH events. And the big thing that I sort of remind you is that we need, if we want to try to understand this phenomenon and do genetic selections, et cetera, for it, to either change. So it happens at division 25. We'd like to look, for instance, for mutations that shift this over to here, that is, delay it, okay? Or shorten it, but delaying is more interesting a priori to us. And
suppose you have a plasmid in that knocks off reactive oxygen species.
Yeah.
You might predict a decrease in carboxylation over a period of time and an increase in lifespan.
Yep.
Or grow under low oxygen conditions.
Yep. Yeah, we haven't done that. There has been a lifespan extension by overexpressing superoxide dismutase that people have known. We haven't looked at that yet for the LOH with that as well. Let's see.
I think I can ask better when I find out.
Okay.
If this is working on some switch, and the switch has to do with the density of these messed up proteins, then you'd expect that, let's say, some of these genes between, some of these cells between 15 and 25 lyse generation has built up enough to cause this phenotype.
Yes.
Okay? But you would then expect that their daughter cells, although they might get the loss of heterozygosity, should almost never inherit the phenotype, because the density was only just barely big enough to turn the switch. But yet, something at 40 or 50 generation,
that's right,
now the daughters should almost entirely inherit this phenotype.
That's right. Uh-huh.
So, yep. In other words, that, and maybe this is just, you may have condensed this because it would have been annoying to present otherwise. When you said that the daughters of, when you were looking at the daughters of older cells, and you said that the what generation the loss of heterozygosity occurred in, that's not distributed evenly over the generation.
Right. That's right. That's right. Yeah.
You didn't present that.
Yeah, I didn't show you. Yeah. Yeah. I've been throwing curves at you all day, so I...
No, that's fine.
Yeah, but you know, you're right on. You're right on. Yep. So it's impossible to do a genetic screen by working on a microscope to do this. So, this is a work of Derek Lindstrom, and he had the idea of sacrificing virgins to be able to do this.
Idea.
Well, that's why I'm giving somebody else credit for the idea. Yeah. Right. So here's the issue for doing genetics. And that is, if you start out with a single mother cell up here that's getting ready to bud, and what I'm trying to portray here is this cell will give rise to this daughter, okay? And then that's the mother after one cell division. Then she gives rise to a new daughter. But those daughters over here give rise to daughters, et cetera. And so it's an exponential function, right? And so if we need to get to division 25, which I was telling you about, then, and we grow up in a colony, or then it's the one we care about is 1 in 33 million. Okay? So there's no way we're going to be able to fish those out of that big a mix. So what about the idea of killing daughters? So what Derek's idea, quite simply, is let's just make sure as soon as a daughter cell is born, she dies, or at least stops dividing, doesn't contribute any further. And if we can stop her at least dividing, not necessarily kill her, then we'll have a million-fold enrichment just like that. Okay? So, how do we do this? So it's a daughter-killing system is what he's developed. We need a mother-daughter distinction that has to be really tight. Killing has to be rapid. It has to happen in one cell division, or at least a cessation of division. And it must be inducible, because we do want to grow the cells up eventually, sometime, you know, to make a culture to start out with. So, what the first part of this has to do with the fact that it is well documented in yeast that there are mother and daughter specific gene expression patterns. And so what Derek took advantage of is he was able to go to the literature and identify a couple of genes that are only expressed in the daughter cell. And so hence, he could put in something that will ultimately kill the daughters under that specific promoter. The second part of the thing is that he used a situation, what we call floxing, which is used quite extensively, where he put lox sites, and lox sites are recombination, regulated recombination elements, that when you add the appropriate enzyme called Cre, they will cause recombination between the two LOXP sites here to eliminate whatever was in between. Okay? And what he did is he put essential genes in between those sites. So, hence, what happens is if that gene disappears, then the daughter cell can't divide anymore because it's an essential gene. And then the third part of this is that he made a version of Cre that we could control with regard to when it worked. And because we were acting on DNA, that is, loxing elements in the chromosome, in the nucleus, he made a version of Cre, the enzyme that acts on LOX, that has an estradiol binding domain. And if you don't have this steroid estradiol in the medium, then the enzyme stays out in the cytoplasm and it can't get to its substrate, the DNA, the chromosome, to flox it out. But when he adds it, then that escorts the thing into the nucleus. Okay? So we can control this thing. And I'll just show you, because there's a bunch of screens that are ongoing right now. What this represents is just a field of cells in which it's been... He's done this analysis with estradiol on a cell for 30 generations, at least the time it would be 30 generations. And what we see in the field on a microscope is this cell and then lots of cells that look like this. And that is what is indicative if we've deleted those essential genes. They rest in what's called G2M. They can't finish dividing. And if you'll notice, I haven't told you about this, but every time a mother yeast gives off a bud, she has a bud scar. And this is a particular stain that allows you to see all the bud scars. And like I told you, to see one that's got 25 buds on it in a normal population is 1 in 33 million, and there's no way in hell you'll see those. Whereas this, you can see it's just whatever it is, 30 cells or 20 cells, whatever is here. He was able to see that quite easily and reproducibly. And furthermore, he labeled the original mother cell with fluorescein on her cell wall, just so we know that that's the original cell, one of the original cells that we started with. Okay, so we've got the system now to be able to do all kinds of genetic screens and selections. Like I said, we don't have the results yet, to be able to ask these questions. Just with the power of the organism, once again. So that's just to give you a flavor for the things that are possible in yeast that I think maybe we'll learn some fundamental questions about these issues of aging. So, yeah?
So how do you define holding yeast cells? How did you define
it?
In the first part, you know.
What I defined old in those cases was all cells after in a pedigree after that first LOH event occurred. And so when we did statistics or analysis, it was all guys after that. So on average, it was after 25 cell divisions. Yeah.
And also, I noticed that when you put yeast plates in like at 4 degrees, you notice that cells that are supposed to, that are white, turn and change into red after some time. Is that somehow related to this phenomenon?
Yeah. So we took advantage of, so in order for that to happen, you have to have a mutation in a gene called ADD2. And that's what we took advantage of to be able to see some of this. Yeah.
Supports the model where you get older because you get less and less efficient at doing things.
Probably, yeah.
And there's one experiment in mammalian cells and culture. This model has been put forth by a number of people. And they tried to test it. There's one experiment where I liked the test, and it didn't agree with this. And I'll tell you what it was. So, and it's in the literature. I don't remember exactly where. So you could take cells, much like this. You would take cells that had gone through 60 generations in culture, and cells that came from foreskin fibroblasts that were, virgin. They were virgin male cells.
Right.
And you would take adenovirus and replicate them in both cells.
Okay.
The idea was that if you made it had a higher error frequency in the efficiency
of
the virus, your particle to PFU ratio,
it would go up in the old
infectious ratio, ought to have been different in young cells and older cells because the error frequency would be different. And by and large, I don't know how gorgeous the results were, I remember, but by and large they weren't so different. And that led them away from the idea that you get less efficient with time because you're accumulating deficits with time.
But could that have had anything to do though with, because that was before the idea of apoptosis and selection, right?
But also there's a lot of asymmetry in what cells do in culture. The two cells divide and then they divide again. Frequently, one of those four cells divide anymore. And
I see.
Funny set of selections is not. I don't think it's as beautiful. And nobody's, people have taken movies of that, but nobody's sat at the microscope. But the idea of less efficient, cells get less efficient at making proteins or at the sort of error rate of translation was a very prevalent idea for a while.
Yeah. Well, I mean, exactly where the defect is happening, that is whether it's error-prone in this case or just accumulated damage and not being able to resynthesize, which I guess are related, is important.
Yeah,
it's critical to this. Yeah.
You don't have any mutations or any way to make those mothers be able to age better, that last longer, or not undergo, or to delay LOS. You don't have those yet, those types of...
Right. The only thing we've been able to do so far is caloric restriction, where we can delay it, but we don't have any genetic ways that we've tried lots, and we can extend lifespan, but we haven't delayed LOH.
Because I'm wondering if it's obviously a multi-genic process, and it makes it really tough. To do, you could pick it apart and maybe figure out how to do it based on this, but to do it with typical genetic techniques, either plasmid expression, random genes, or whatever, might be impossible.
Yeah. Well, one thing that we do have, so Michael, for other projects in the lab, we have a lot of wild yeast strains, that is, natural isolates, let's say. That we got from Bob Mortimer up at UC Berkeley. And they come from all over the world. He collected them in different vineyards. And we started looking at loss of heterozygosity and aging in these wild guys. And we have one strain that lives to 100 instead of 40. And it doesn't have loss of heterozygosity. We've never seen it in this guy. We then take haploids from our guy and this guy. And they now go down to 40. Their age lifespan is 40, but they don't have loss of heterozygosity. So we now have the opportunity, to do polygenic analysis to see what the loci are to separate this. So that's another thing
that's
we're doing.
Tool.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right.
But the loss of heterozygosity look like it's a single. Sporulate, I think, that separate.
So what we've done, and this is in collaboration with one of our, actually, he's now at Princeton, Leonid Krugliak, he just moved, one of my colleagues at Seattle, is we sporulated them, and then we have started the analysis. We haven't finished, but we've got 100 strains now of haploid rearrangements, in which we have everything mapped now. And we're starting to see that it's more than one locus, at least in the difference between these two guys. We don't know how many, though, yet. It doesn't segregate 2 to 2, for instance. That's simple. So.
Well, just a little comment, philosophical thing. If you really thought, if you got a strain out there that doesn't have any LOH, lives that long, is there and it's rare. I mean, those tend to be the rare ones.
Yeah.
Very rare, right? Is there some advantage to this? I mean,
this is an age-old argument. Yeah. Evolutionary biologists, especially, say that once you're beyond your reproductive potential, then it doesn't matter. There's no selection. It's completely random, and so.
Disastrous to have everyone still alive for the next generation here, because you use the resources
of the
your offspring. And one of the real principles of evolution is you've got to change to live because the environment keeps changing.
So what about that strange yeast strain that appears to escape it? 100 generations, no LOH.
Well, it came from Italy, southern Italy, and so it may have been living a very good life.
Good.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, there's a very interesting sort of observation thing so far, maybe it's wrong, and that is that if it was simply genetic and you could alter that, you could get a mutant that would be immortal.
Right.
So that we ought to find, have heavy selection pressure for immortal strains of everything.
Yeah.
And yet we find nothing. I don't know, the record is 4,000-year-old trees or something, but there are very few things that are, well, there's never been anything that's been seen to be immortal. It has the danger, of course, of using all the resources as well.
Yeah, and, you know, and we've only done this under one condition.
Yeah.
So.
There is a finite, I mean, even with the best genetics you can do, you get maybe the 4 lifespans before it pops.
Yeah.
Before things happen. So there are finite limits, even in changing the genes.
Yeah, it is.
You know, diabetes, they diagnose diabetes often now by glycosylation of protein. Because what you do is you have so much glucose that's not being important in the cells.
It just coats the.
Glycosylates with hemoglobin.
Yep. Yeah, there's so many side reactions.
Yeah,
it's a
lot of reactivity. Yeah.
Yep, absolutely. So that's why we're taking, I mean, I've given you a biased view here, but we're taking hopefully an unbiased approach right now. We're trying to.
Is there some way that you can experimentally zap the carbonylated proteins in the cells reset?
Well, I don't know about that. I'm not familiar with zapping them per se, but there are mechanisms to prevent, and that's what Arnie was asking about, using these dismutases, oxidizing dismutases. So, yeah.
Because then you would expect that
we haven't done it for the loss of heterozygosity, but it does improve lifespan. Other people have shown that.
Would you be able to see, so maybe some longevity, long-lived yeast strains will have alterations in mitochondrial DNA? Do you look at that?
So I didn't get into that at all, but I sort of gave you the sugar-coated version. We see that every one of those guys that has LOH became petite before it underwent LOH. That said, we thought, we were very excited that was completely causal. So we took some of those petites and put them through the pedigree, and we saw that they don't go all the way to the low rate, but they are slightly elevated, but then they'll go even higher when they hit division 25. So it looks like two events have to happen because we have other yeast. This one that never has LOH, it never forms a petite. It's a correlation right now, but it's smelling like that. So that's possibly why it's multigenic also, that you need to have an effect in the mitochondria and then something else going on as well in order to get this. So. Yeah, we have some COX genes and an ATPase. So we'll see if they are the real deal or not. Yeah.
It's a different question, but have you ever tested whether this old cell, after it throws on the buds and it gets old and it doesn't bud anymore, have you ever put it in a sporulation media and check whether it's spoiled, it's formed?
Yeah, no, it's simply because we don't have enough. But now that we have this way to do this aging, we can do those kinds of experiments. And so, yeah, those would be fun to do, actually. It's called chitin. It's a type of polysaccharide that is laid down so initially, maybe I can draw it better. Does it what? It doesn't disrupt, but there's a probability that it won't happen there because the choice of where the next bud will be is there's a memory, if you will, from where that bud happened. And in yeast, if there's in Cerevisiae, if this is the sphere and the first bud is here, then there are two pathways that are generally used. One is called axial budding. And the next bud will come right next to that one, and the next, and the next, and next. And in fact, if I go back, you can see a little bit of that here. See how these follow up like a chain, like here? So that's axial budding. And so there's a program of GTPases, et cetera, that are deposited on the membrane, and they regulate that. Now, coming back to what the chitin scar is when you... As the bud comes off, you start out with a mother that has a cell wall. In order for her to make something, she has to break down this wall in order for things to start to expand. And what happens is the cell wall breaks down, changes, and you get a new kind of cell wall being made that eventually comes the daughter. Where that initially happened is this ring of chitin gets laid down because that's where the cell will break off. And before she breaks off, it gets filled in with new cell wall material so that neither the mother nor the daughter is compromised to the space outside. So that's what that's about.
So you don't run into a problem if you work with a very, very long, there's no room effect?
Yeah, that was the original hypothesis about aging, that was the limit, and it turned out that it isn't.
Use up all your space.
Yeah, right, yeah.
You mean the ones that live on the generations, they start to overlap?
So yeah, we see them overlapping, yeah. So.
Is there an equivalent of aging in capillary?
Oh yeah, sure.
They exactly the same?
It's a little bit different, We can't see loss of heterozygosity, but aging regulation is pretty much the same. They live a little shorter, though, actually.
But you can take an old mother through meiosis and she can become the virgin again? The four prophets become virgin?
We've never been able to do that, only because we've done everything by pedigree and we can't get a high enough efficiency for them to go through. So we might be able to with this technology now to ask that question. But we don't know.
The answer to the question is unknown.
Yeah, we don't know.
No, we
do not know.
Because there are a whole set of gene expressions in meiosis
yep.
that would be very informative if it was regenerative.
Yep. Yep. Absolutely. Yep.
Usually in things like planaria, which have lifespans,
yep.
Meiosis is regenerative, but there's a macronucleus and a micronucleus that's very a lot more complicated than that. But meiosis is usually when you use, when you throw away the macronucleus and you get the micronucleus down the meiosis, you get old.
Yeah, so instillated protozoa like the Hypertrix and Holotrix, yep. You definitely get senescence. And yeah, and that's usually micronuclear. Right, Ed?
The depends. Some ciliates, you have...
That's true, it's the other way.
Like the paramecium.
That's true. I forgot about that.
So you get micronuclear senescence, but you can still live forever, like a tetrahymena. But you lose the micronuclear senescence is due to lost chromosomes, so it's reflected in loss of fertility when they go through the sexual process.
Okay. So both ways. Yeah, both ways.
But meiosis is usually very regenerative.
Yeah, right, you erase everything.
Yeah, you erase all of yep. The epigenetic traits of
the DNA. And a priori, I would expect it would in Cerevisiae, but gosh, I just don't know. Because the spores, I mean, they basically are just nuclei with just the tiniest bit of cytoplasm in them. So.
Why don't we thank them?
Oh, yeah, sure.